Good morning.
Hello. Just a few questions about how you might vote. Wages Pollster is working for a legitimate polling company. No skin in the game at all. Or are we? Here's Brian Dobson with Sinn Féin's Eoin Óibrin on Wednesday.
Before I let you go, I'd like to get your response to that report in the Irish Independent today that Sinn Féin members posed as opinion pollsters. They were, it suggested, supplied with fake IDs for a non-existent polling company and were questioning people about their voting intentions. Can you confirm that Sinn Féin engaged in this?
Yes, so particularly over the period from 2010 onwards, we would have done an amount of what we call localised polling. We're not the only political party to do it. It's a practice that's quite widespread. Mm. And given the expense of polls, particularly when our party was smaller and had less resources, it was a key way for us to, I suppose, try and level the playing field with the bigger parties who often had more resources.
So your party members who presented themselves as employees of Irish Market Research Agency, that's an agency which doesn't exist, and they identified themselves as that on the doorsteps.
Yeah, I'd be very upfront with you. We would have done exactly that kind of local polling. Again, I would stress we're not the only political party that does it. Now that we have more resources,
perhaps not quite in this way. Other parties certainly say they employ polling companies, but the issue here is Sinn Féin members misrepresenting themselves as pollsters to voters.
Well, these individuals were engaged in collecting polling data in a very straightforward way. That data was always anonymised and used solely for the purposes of polling. And again, I would say we are not the only political party that engages in this.
Well, did your members have, were they supplied with fake IDs?
They would have had ID badges that would have had their real names and photographs and the name of a marketing research company.
So effectively, they lied to people on the doorsteps.
I wouldn't describe it as lying to people on the doorsteps. They were out collecting polling data for the purposes of...
But they knowingly misrepresented themselves as employees of a company that didn't exist.
I suppose the only thing I can say, Brian, is this is a common part of election practices.
What a tangled web we weave. But Sinn Féin's Eoin Óibrin was right on one thing. They weren't the only ones. Here comes Fine Gael's Leo Varadkar with Cormac.
You've said this afternoon that this has never happened within Fine Gael since you took over as leader 4 years ago. But were you ever aware of this happening within Fine Gael previous to that?
Well, quite frankly, yes. This isn't something that we've done since 2016 or even before that. But certainly prior to that, we would have done something similar. Either volunteers or either volunteers would have been asked to do surveys door to door, or students would have been paid to do it, and would have been done on a similar basis, anonymised for the purposes of polling. But like I say, that practice has been discontinued.
When did it stop?
Certainly 2016, 2017. I was trying to check that out earlier, maybe as far back as 2014, but certainly not in the last 5, 6, 7 years.
Opposing pollsters, so 2014 and 2015, right up to 2016. And can we add Fianna Fáil to this list? Oh, is Fagerlin? Yes, we can. On Wednesday evening, they admitted that prior to 2007, on occasion, party members did pose as market researchers. Here's Katie on Late Debate with Fianna Fáil Senator Lorraine Clifford Lee.
First of all, Fianna Fáil gave a statement to The Independent on Saturday saying that the party does not and is not aware of any members or candidates carrying out opinion polls under the guise of fake market research companies. That would appear now not to be the case. And then earlier today, your colleague, Senator Mary Fitzpatrick, issued a statement saying that she was astounded to read that Sinn Féin activists were given detailed instructions on how to pose as researchers working for a polling company to covertly question voters. This is a direct quote from Mary Fitzpatrick from the statement. I'm of the view that any other political party would quite rightly be held to account if they were found to be using a similar strategy, and Sinn Féin should be no different.
Well, you said the statement came out from Fianna Fáil this evening. They obviously went back and really thoroughly researched the methods that were used, and they discovered a small amount of instances prior to 2007.
No, it's a small amount.
Well, they said it was supplemented. The data or the polling data done by private companies. So that would suggest it was a small amount. It was prior to 2007. What we're talking about with Sinn Féin was 2016. Now, we're a world apart in terms of our understanding of data. The GDPR directive was issued by the EU in 2015, and we would have been very aware, and the conversation would have started in relation to the importance of data.
So what was the
collection,
difference?
And particularly,
what's the difference particularly between 2006 and 2016? Turning up at somebody's door and pretending
you're wrong.
From a company.
It is. I'm not defending that practice at all. It's completely wrong.
Well, Mark McSharry says it is extremely worrying. This is when he thought it was Sinn Féin was up to it. He found it extremely worrying, and I don't know anybody involved in politics up to now who would have engaged in some subversion in the modern democratic world, and he couldn't see why it wouldn't constitute Garda involvement.
Well, you'll have to ask Mark McSharry about that statement, but I'm sure he didn't know that this was actually occurring within Fianna Fáil prior to 2007.
Squirm. And then the Green Party. Here's Deputy Leader Minister Catherine Martin on Thursday's News at One, who said her party was investigating some isolated incidents from over a decade ago.
This should never have happened. It has no place in politics. We are investigating it thoroughly. I believe our executive will look into details. Yeah. We're still gathering the details, and we'll, of course, contact the Data Protection Commissioner.
So, but at this stage,
well,
you don't know how many constituencies, where it occurred, or even precisely when.
It's well over a decade ago. Some of these volunteers may have well left the party, but I think I just want to state as well, you know, this seems to have been quite a widespread practice amongst many political parties, and at a time when we need to instill confidence in the body politics, this certainly doesn't do that. We must be seen to learn from mistakes, give people reassurances that it would never happen, that it's not happening.
I'm just
now
wondering, if you can't get to the bottom of what you say was happening, how do you know what isn't happening at the moment?
Well, that's what I think really needs to be. I think every political party needs to go on the record and say this practice has ceased.
But I'm wondering, how do you know?
This is not happening in the Green Party now. I'm deputy leader since 2011. I'm on the executive committee since 2010. And to the very best of my knowledge, this is not happening. And I think all political parties need to come out.
All political parties need to come out? Well, there were very few left in at this point. And that was to be something of a refrain. They were all at it, with the notable exception of Labour's Alan Kelly, who said that to his knowledge, his party hadn't joined Pollsters Anonymous. And the same for the Social Democrats. Fair play. On Wednesday's Drive Time, Sarah spoke to Jennifer Kavanagh, law lecturer at Waterford Institute of Technology and author of Electoral Law in Ireland, who said, shocker, there might well be some ethical issues around the case of saying you were from a company that just didn't exist.
There's duties on nowadays and data controllers, data processors, and say, for example, if you're filling out a survey, you will always have a contact person of who to bring up any queries to later on. And if they were saying that students were going out and asking people information, that's not even something that undergraduates are allowed to do, because you need ethical approval for that kind of situation, because some information may bring up issues for people and they need to know who they can go and talk to. But if it's for a company that doesn't exist, or they're being opaque about who is collecting the data, what is the purpose of the data collection, there are significant, just even ethical issues surrounding that.
OK, so there are ethical issues. Are there legal issues?
The legal issues would be that if somebody wanted to follow it up and get access to their personal information that they had given, they would not be able to pursue that right. And that's where the main issue would have been under the Data Protection Act of 1988. Now, under the GDPR regulations, as you've already said, that they say it's not happening now, there are even broader and stronger rights. But definitely under what was enforced at the time, there would have been issues of people wanting to enforce their rights against the people who are collecting the data, because the company that they were told they were giving data to didn't exist, so they would have no way of following through with that.
But what of the defence? They were all doing it, miss.
To say that, well, we were doing it and other people were doing it and it may turn out that other parties were doing it, we don't know. That excuse doesn't work for kids in secondary school who are being put on detention. You can't just say, well, my friend was also doing it, therefore I shouldn't be in trouble. So all our information, as I said, it's so important, not just to political parties, but to everyone else that wants to gather information on people. And the information is the lifeblood of how society works at nowadays. So people just have to be so careful with their data, when they're giving it out, who is looking for it, what is the reason for seeking this information. You're entitled to those answers. And people just have to be very careful. It's always something that we have treasured very much in Irish society, especially in elections, because not only do the political parties want that information, that's how they figure out where they're going to poll and everything, but also us as citizens who are making the decisions politically at the end of the day as to who we're going to elect, we have to be aware of how our information could be used.
Law lecturer Dr. Jennifer Kavanagh on Drive Time. Could I see some ID, please? Maybe real ID? Thanks. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Misha Freshen, Part 2, Bank Holiday Monday. Ray Wingnut Cudahy took us by the hand and brought us on the wildest of tramps across the musical fields of folk, trad and hip-hop.
Misha Freshen, every single track a bright, shining gem. Check out the Beyonce one. On Sunday, Brendan O'Connor spoke to the godfather of positive psychology, Professor Martin Seligman. And if you're one of those lucky glass half full, slightly annoying people, well, good for you, she said through gritted teeth.
Optimistic people live longer. And so we control for risk factors like obesity, blood pressure, cholesterol. And we measure optimism and pessimism at age 60. And we look over the next 20 years and ask, who dies? And it turns out, holding all the risk factors constant, if you're in the bottom quartile of pessimism, that's equivalent to smoking about 3 packs of cigarettes a day. Wow. So optimistic people live between 6 and 8 years longer than pessimistic people, and their illnesses are less severe.
Living longer is one thing, but are they really happier? Yeah, transpires they are, and they're more successful. Is there no end to their chirpiness? But if life is so very lovely for these optimists, how do the rest of us get in on the act?
Every night, before you go to sleep, for the next week, write down 3 things that went well and why they went well. And what we find is that when people merely do that, they don't have to be big things. They can be a sunset or a Yeats poem. When people do that, they become addicted to it. They sleep better. Happiness and life satisfaction 6 months later are better, and depression is lower.
And for relationships, he had this advice.
It comes out of marriage counseling. And basically, traditionally, what you do in marriage counseling is you try to make insufferable marriage is barely tolerable. By teaching people, try to teach people to fight better. And that's no fun. But about 15 years ago, a field of positive marriage counseling arose in which you teach people about how to celebrate together as opposed to how to fight better. And the key to that is, what do you say to your spouse when she comes home with a victory? And most people say things like, congratulations, dear, you deserve it, or what's for dinner, or, you know, what's tax bracket that's going to put us into. None of those things help relationships. What does help relationships is active, constructive responding to good events. Now, tell me, dear, exactly where were you when your boss gave you the raise? She tells you. Tell me exactly what did he say? She repeats it. And let's go open a bottle of Dom Perignon. When you learn active, constructive responding in marriage counseling to victory, sex gets better, love and commitment go up, and divorce goes down.
And all of this, very simply, a way of accentuating the positive.
The crucial thing is getting people's attention on reliving the good things in life.
Okay.
So the good things, just, you know, we're bad weather animals. We're built to watch out for catastrophe. And when good things occur, they just roll off our back. The important thing about teaching positive psychology is to put people attending to it and to stay in touch with it. And that's the crucial thing here, is attending to what's positive in your life.
Professor Martin Seligman with Brendan. Technology, data, power and money intersected across a few stories this week. In an operation codenamed Trojan Shield, the FBI and Australia created an encrypted messaging service sold as secure, unhackable even, to criminals. But in fact, they were eavesdropping at the highest levels, privy to the darkest of deeds. Over 20 million messages in 45 languages between 300 gangs in 100 countries. On Drive Time, Conor Lally, security and crime editor at the Irish Times, joined Samantha with more details.
The scale of this really is unlike anything I've ever seen before, quite frankly. This story really begins 2 years ago. A man in the US who basically came up with IT products that were, you know, quite often used by organised crime, he came up with this handset. It was a special mobile phone handset with an app on it that would send text and images between two handsets. And he was an FBI informant at the time, back in 2019. And as he essentially invented this handset and app, he handed it over to the US authorities. They really then worked with the Australian police, and they were able to introduce this phone and app into organised crime all over the world. There was one man in particular, he is of Turkish origin, but he's actually from Australia. He is based in Turkey, and he supplies quite a bit of the drugs to Australia through the country. And he was essentially recommending this particular handset to, you know, the people that he worked with in organised crime in Australia and internationally. And he seems to have been one of the key people who spread the phone through organised crime.
And the phone itself? Devastating in its simplicity.
So they were regular mobile phones, but they had been specifically set up only to be able to use this particular Anon app. It worked a little bit like WhatsApp. You could send text, you could send photographs and so on. But the phones that the app was on weren't able to do anything else. You weren't able to go online. You weren't able to call anybody on it. If anybody examined the actual handset, it would look like a regular mobile phone. But when you went into the calculator section of the phone, that's where this app was actually hidden. And it enabled people to talk to each other. You had to have known somebody who had a phone in order to get your hands on one. You know, these weren't items that you're able to buy online or in a shop. You had to be recommended by other people who were also involved in organised crime. And when you bought one of these phones, you paid €1,500 up front for the actual handset and for using the phone for 6 months. And once that period was over, you paid about €1,200 then per month to use that service. So anybody recommending these phones to anybody else, as I understand it, they would get a cut of that cash as the phones spread. And by the time this operation emerged publicly, there were 12,000 people on this system all over the world, and we believe either all of them or the vast majority of them were within organised crime, but all the while they were completely unaware that this was actually an FBI Trojan horse that was effectively, you know, keeping an eye on them and reading all of their texts as they went back and forward.
And because they all thought they were on a secure system, they sang like canaries.
They, you know, called each other often by their name. You know, they gave locations as to where they were, as to where they, you know, collected drugs. They gave information about the price of drugs consignments, where they would end up. It showed how they planned, you know, gangland killings and so on. So there's real insight here into the, you know, day-to-day granular operation of organised crime.
Conor Lally of the Irish Times on Drive Time. And with communications compromised, how will this affect business? Michael O'Sullivan is the director of the Maritime Analysis and Operations Centre, and he spoke to Mary on Wednesday's Morning Ireland.
Once their communication system is gone, the fallout from it is enormous, the number of arrests, and that effect cascades down through the entire criminal network, and it leads in many cases to the dismantling and disruption of organised crime. It's a huge blow to them.
And you believe, Michael, that its reach will be will reach as far as Irish crime gangs as well, that it's inconceivable they would not be caught within the net of this sting.
Well, unfortunately for the Irish, Mary, some of the biggest organised crime groups in Europe contain and are managed by Irish criminals. So some of the really big ones are very much the senior management team are Irish. So I have no doubt that in one way or another, it would affect, if not them personally, their operations or their employees, for want of a better term, or the people who work with them, who supplied them with cash or supplied them with drugs.
But given the number of messages and scale of the operation, what level of crime were the authorities privy to, and what forced their hand to end the operation?
Why now? Why would international law enforcement decide to end the sting operation at this stage, to reveal the operation? And along the way, what might have had to be overlooked for a greater haul? Could that have included major drugs hauls? Could it have included crimes up to and including murder?
It's too difficult to say. It's really that's a question for Europol, and in these type of operations they have to make a judgment call. But again, not for me to say. But I would have no doubt that they brought this operation to the limit and perhaps saw a point that they couldn't continue with it for various operational reasons. And sometimes in operations you gather so much evidence that it is practical and pragmatic to take the action now as distinct from letting it run down the road.
Michael O'Sullivan on Morning Ireland. But if tech can be used to bring criminals down, it can also work the other way, as the recent HSE attack proved. And on Tuesday, a shudder. The websites of the Irish Times, the BBC, the New York Times, CNN, the Financial Times, streaming service Spotify, payment service Stripe, as well as the UK government and the White House, all down. Was this another cyber attack? Thankfully, no. Here's Ronan Murphy of Smart Tech 247, who joined Damien on Tuesday just before 12.
It's rectified now and all of the sites are back up and running. I guess what all of these companies have in common is that they use a service from an American-based cloud computing company called Fastly. And I mean, it's the who's who that use them, from Twitter to Slack to Accenture and, you know, many of the media outlets. And unfortunately, these guys had an issue where their platform was down. And as a consequence, there was a lot of people panicking because it looked like there was a massive global cyber attack taking place. But in fact, it was just this content distribution network which was down. I think it raises some interesting questions about the internet and about its resilience when stuff like this happens. It's definitely a very thought-provoking issue.
Well, thought-provoking is one way to look at it, or silent scream panic. particularly when the Irish Independence tech expert Adrian Reckler came on the news at one to tell us something like this. Not unusual.
We don't know exactly the technical nature of the problem that Fastly had, but these type of outages aren't that unusual. Last year, we saw a similar one with a huge company called Cloudflare. The year before that, we saw one with Amazon Web Services. And these companies essentially have, there's so much web traffic going through them that when something goes wrong at any of them, it knocks out huge swathes of the world's access to the most popular websites. And in Ireland, it's a particularly acute thing because up to a third of all of Europe's internet data actually goes through Ireland. We have an unusual concentration here of data centers and servers, and some of the biggest tech companies like Microsoft, Google and Facebook have absolutely massive data centers here. So there is always this question of how much we are forcing into the internet infrastructure funnels that we have, particularly in Ireland. And this will be another example of that.
Gulp. Well, on Drive Time, Cormac spoke to Professor Barry O'Sullivan from the School of Computer Science in UCC. And this was in the context of looking for more robust EU-wide defences against cybercrime.
Are we particularly vulnerable here, Barry, in Ireland? We're in a unique position in a way, in the sense that we are a small country, but we have attracted an awful lot of the world's leaders in terms of tech companies.
Well, I think we are. Obviously, you know, the Facebooks and Googles of the world don't rely on the Irish state necessarily for their protection. They take good care of themselves. But we do have a reputational dimension to this. So, you know, we do need to be able to show that we are not only a high-tech centre and a high-tech hub for the big companies, but we're also able to participate and defend ourselves at a world-class level also. So, you know, hence the need for as much investment as possible. You know, I think...
Has Ireland's reputation been damaged then in that regard because of the recent cyber attack?
Well, you know, we're doing nationally, we're doing the very best we can, but it, you know, it certainly puts the spotlight on Ireland. And I think the fact that, you know, we do have we've had a vacancy at very senior levels of national cyber, that's not good. The fact that we have national infrastructure that's running on old systems for whatever reason, that's not good. You know, our investment in cybersecurity nationally isn't very high. That's not good either. So, you know, they certainly don't help our reputations. We have had a little bit of egg in our face in this one.
Ooh, you'd like to wipe that off your chin. But while we may picture tech wizards cranking out sophisticated codes to hack into all and sundry, the reality is a little more prosaic.
It's a cat and mouse game. I suppose in cybersecurity, one of the things that we often sort of falsely believe is that it's a high-tech game, that technology defends us. But of course, the big vulnerability in all of these things is the human being. You know, the human being is the weak link. And you might hear people talking about social engineering and these sorts of things. That's just essentially criminals, you know, convincing you or tricking you into sharing passwords and other credentials. It's very, very mundane stuff, but you know, cybersecurity is high tech, but it's also very, very low tech and very, you know, psychology driven.
Professor Barry O'Sullivan. So playback 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all lowercase? Maybe not. But we're going to have to get with the programme one way or the other.
The last thing me and you want to do now, Ray, sound like two old fellas talking about how technology is just too complicated to use.
No,
and wasn't it better in the good old days?
No, I'm just...
Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Wednesday, Ray Darcy got a schooling. Bloody Twitter.
A slap on the wrist already. Or not even on the air, 20 seconds. Before you start, it says, Jim Smith was tweeting, it's Philip Lynott and not Philip Linnett or even Phil Linnett. Yeah, you see, I've been saying Phil Linnett for all these years on the radio, talking to people, and little did I know it was Phil Lynott, or maybe even Philip Lynott. So I'll be saying Lynott from here on in, and people will look at me and they'll laugh, but I will say that's the correct pronunciation.
Well, here's the guest who's just made a documentary on Philo to throw a spanner in the works.
I still say Phil in it. Sorry, I know I heard you say I'm supposed to say it correctly.
No, some guy corrected me and I saw you corrected somebody else. I was watching an interview you did with somebody and you said it's Linus, not Linus.
They say it's Philip Linus. That's how he liked to be called. But I think Dubliners or Irish people grew up with Phil in it. Just, it's very hard to change.
Brilliant. I'm glad you said that. I'm glad you said that because I'll be, you know, Phil in it's fine by me as well. So let's say that.
Excellent.
Phew. And that is the voice of Emer Reynolds, the Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, whose new documentary, Songs for While I'm Away, tells the story of Crumlin's finest. And with the name Minefield negotiated, Emer talked about the allure and charisma of the man and the music.
You put him down as a rocker and the boys are back in town, yeah, go on. But actually now that I listen to the lyrics after watching the documentary, he was very, very talented.
Yeah, it's an incredible thing. It's, you know, you say you see him as a rocker. I certainly, as a young fan, saw the image, you know, the legs that went on forever and the massive afro and the twinkle and how incredibly charismatic and confident he was on stage.
And sexy, you can say that.
Sexy, yeah, absolutely. And then to realise how shy and private he was and in some ways crafted and created this kind of uber rocker macho persona as a kind of maybe as Adam Clayton says in the film, as armour, you know, in a way to defend his sensitive inner side. And yes, the lyrics, is that's an underknown and underappreciated part of the story, I think, too, how hardworking he was, how creative, what an incredible writer, you know, the range and breadth of the lyrics and the songs.
And the storytelling, let's just play a bit of this.
When I passed you in the doorway, well, you took me with a glance. I should have took that last bus home, but I asked you for a dance. Now we go steady to the pictures. I always get chocolate stains on my pants. And my father, he's going crazy. He says I'm living in a trance.
Come on, Emer, here we go.
Dancing in the moonlight.
You see that description, and I used to always quote it back. You know, got chocolate stains on my pants because I always did. And you know what an observation.
Well, it typifies. It absolutely encapsulates exactly what it was like. I think to be a teenager, walking home. You know, when you've had maybe a dance or a moment with somebody at a disco, and you're walking home and missed the bus. You know, he absolutely wasn't afraid to write in his own vernacular, in his own experience. Yeah. You know what we knew at that age.
And she talked about how his upbringing in a pretty impoverished Dublin of the 1950s had shaped him.
It's an incredible part of his story, how he forged, you know, his path out of such humble beginnings, you know, like from a working class area of Dublin in the 50s, where they talk about him as being the only black kid in the country or the only black child in the school. I mean, he probably wasn't, but I'm sure he felt like that. It was a very monochromatic culture at that stage, and to have, you know, to have dreamed his way out of that and to have ended up on the steps of the Sydney Opera House in front of 100,000 screaming fans, you know, it's an incredible story. It's an incredible journey of what you can do with your dreams.
I'm still in love with you. You know, some people out there are saying time has its way of healing. It can dry all the tears from your eyes. Oh, but darling, they don't tell you about this empty feeling. You know I can disguise it.
They're all singing along at home now.
That's one of my favourite songs. I mean, didn't he have it all? When you look at when you hear that and you see the lyrics, the quality of the lyrics, the beautiful melody, the sound, the performance, and the voice, like what a voice, the velvet.
Yeah.
Gorgeous.
And this is the thing, and a lot of people talk a lot now about vulnerability. He wasn't And although he had that rock image and the leather trousers, as you describe it, and that overtly sexual image, he wasn't afraid to be vulnerable.
And all of the albums will show you that. If you go back through all the albums, you'll find these big, heavy metal, heavy rock songs. You know, they're loud and noisy and sexy and confident. And then you'll find beautiful songs like Still in Love with You that are that are delicate and show an inner life that isn't so easy to see.
Emma Reynolds with Ray on her documentary Songs for While I'm Away. A year like no other seemed to be the phrase repeated again and again when it came to the leaving cert, which started this week. But one thing that remained constant were the sacrifices many parents made for their children's education and their future. Unlike family on Bank Holiday Monday, Brenda went to Cavan to speak to Binny, whose own parents had made sure she could avail of every opportunity back in her native India.
Every penny they earned, and Lord have mercy on my hero of my life is my father. I can still remember how he and my mom struggled, rearing three daughters and bringing them through their education. And on top of that, there's a culture in India, you have to pay dowry. And I remember the day that my dad went out to borrow money from his friends to pay for my nursing. And he stood like a strong man and he told that this is not your problem. Like in I know Irish talk, he went out and he got all the money and he told, okay, here, what do you want to do? And I told, I would like to do nursing.
And she did nursing. While she built her career in Ireland, her husband and her two young children remained in India, where Binny's mother cared for her boys.
So basically, my mum took over my two children only because of her, and I never have enough words to thank her. My parents was the parents for my two children until I bring them here. So I know how beautiful my mum is and how strong person she is and how caring she is. So there was not a second thought.
And when she moved to Ireland, life was very, very different.
I'm thinking of you as this young mother coming over here to a country you didn't really know anything about to a county you didn't really know anything about, Cavan. No. What were your impressions and how did it compare to where you had come from in India?
The very first thing, I was putting my feet in a flight. I didn't know how to put a seatbelt on in the flight, you know. I didn't even know how to operate a microwave or a Hoover. What are the purpose of these things? Like, for example, washing machine. Can I not have a bucket and a soap to wash my clothes and heating? Why you want to heat your food every time? I never heated my food every time when I'm eating in my life. To be honest, I never used a kettle in my life at that stage. I'm talking about 16 years before, like in India. You have to change everything. It cost me financially so much to come over to Ireland. So my first aim was to pay back all the debts in India. Coming here and working in this country is a blessing and was a blessing and it will be a blessing always. But it was not an easy thing. I miss the little voices, I miss the little fingers and the toes, the little shoes that whenever every time I go for a shopping to Dunn's or Tesco, I still remember there was little shoes hanging and there were little boys' clothes hanging. The age will be there and I see 0 to 6 months, 6 months to 1 year. The one income in the nursing home kept me go because to pay the rent, to keep the show go. So I have to find a second job also. I used to work 4 nights in one nursing home and 2 nights in a nursing home in Virginia to earn enough money to keep my show go. Everything was one breadwinning was me. And I have to work like that.
Binny is now the director of nursing at the Esker Lodge Nursing Home in Cavan. Her husband and children have joined her, and this week her son Nabish sits the leaving cert.
Leaving cert is hard enough as it is, you know, with it being the year that pretty much decides your life.
What do you want to do?
Like some sciencey, medicine or biomedical science, most likely.
That'll be a fair few points.
It will.
Yeah.
Oh, no missing there. That was Nabish with Brenda on Like Family, and best of luck to all the students. Oliver, too, was all over the leaving cert.
Question for you at home, everyone in the back of the class. What is the leaving cert Oscailge, right? Leaving cert Oscailge, put that in your mind now and learn it off. Here's an alternative look at it. An Irish drill rapper is making a remix of the leaving cert poem on Spalpín Fánach.
Could I? Lay in Ishka Kurumach the screwed fop here, the troll of Oxford Kestina,
There you go, that's Fade, produced by Don't Choke, and it's all about Unspalpin Phonak. So did you get it? And Scrodo na Heart Hisht America. That's it. The Irish Owls and the Owlfellas pretend to be teenagers on the Irish tape. Oh, they may acknowledge on this discotheque. He's going, you're 55, what are you doing with all these 17-year-olds? Anyway.
Indeed. Moving on.
Come here, you. What poems are coming up on the junior and the leaving?
Well, you might ask. Turns out June is peak popularity time for poets, as Rachel Hegarty told us on Sunday Miscellany.
I'm in our local supermarket in Fingus, and one of me ma's pals, Mrs. Buckley, thinks I might have some inside info on the state exams. She has one child doing the junior and another doing the leaving. Word had gone around our estate. The youngest Heggo girl is doing a master's in poetry at Trinity. Poetry? I ask you. But it's exam season, and the parents of Finglas examinees are just as desperate for help as any. And so began my now 20-year habit of offering free poetry grinds of a June bank holiday. Word had spread among the Mammy Mafia, and there were even a couple of kids from the south side. For those who can't be bothered with poetry, I ask them to tell me the name of their favourite song in the charts. We look up the lyrics. Lo and behold, even Stormzy uses metre. Form, images, symbols, line-end rhymes, internal chimes and half-rhymes. The first Wednesday after the June bank holiday and the exams begin, some kind of lovely normal is returning. And that is pure poetry.
Rachel Hegarty, as heard on Sunday Miscellany. And on Bank Holiday Monday, the RTE Concert Orchestra and Friends celebrated poet Emily Dickinson.
Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me.
Hope is the thing with feathers by Emily Dickinson. And now think back to the dark, dark days of January. And on Thursday, Damien brought us this small but significant piece of news.
I'm just looking at a tweet which has come in here from geriatrician Joe Harbison saying, fantastic news. We've just been informed that St. James's, the biggest hospital in the country, has no inpatients with COVID for the first time since March 2020, which brings me nicely.
Oh, now that's what you want to hear. And more good news this week with the very first outdoor gig with James Vincent McMorrow. So many reasons to be cheerful. That is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. Bring me home.